From the Blue Ridge Mountains to the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia is a mecca for outdoor travel and adventure. Virginia Outdoor Adventures podcast is the ultimate guide for local outdoor recreation, including hiking, camping, kayaking, and so much more. Get the information and the inspiration to plan your own adventure right here in Virginia. I'm your host, Jessica Bowser. What is it about waterfalls that draw us in? Perhaps it's the mesmerizing sight of free-falling cascades, or the sound of a soothing trickle or a powerful thundering roar. Maybe it's the feeling of mist that dusts our skin, or the fresh scent of moisture and earth mixing in the air. Shenandoah National Park is home to dozens of waterfalls that attract thousands of visitors every year. Ranger Kevin Moses, the park search and rescue coordinator, highlights some of his favorite falls, interesting facts about the formation of the park's natural features, and how to prepare for a hike so you can safely enjoy the power and beauty of Shenandoah's waterfalls. Let's go! Virginia Outdoor Adventures is sponsored by the Virginia Association for Parks. VAFP is the advocacy organization representing parks across the Commonwealth. What's your favorite memory from a Virginia park? Help ensure that everyone can experience our parks for generations to come. Join VAFP today by visiting virginiaparks.org or click Virginia Association for Parks in the show notes of your listening app. Kevin, welcome to Virginia Outdoor Adventures.
Thank you, Jessica. I'm honored to be here.
What do you love about Virginia's outdoors?
I love everything about Virginia's outdoors. Virginia has it all. It's got it all. It's got ocean shoreline. It's got the Chesapeake Bay. It's got the Appalachian Mountains, free-flowing rivers. And in those mountains, there's exposed rocky summits, waterfalls, which we're going to spend a lot of time talking about today. So I kind of think of Virginia as the mountains to the sea, you know, the Appalachian Mountains all the way to the Atlantic Ocean.
Kevin, how did you become a ranger at Shenandoah National Park?
Shenandoah is my fifth park that I've worked at. Prior to coming here, I worked at four other national parks or national monuments, national rivers. The thing about the National Park Service is we think of all of our park units as parks, but many of them are actually a national battlefield, a national military park, a national lakeshore, etc. So I've worked at five total, and this is my fifth one. I guess I'm lucky because a lot of folks don't figure out what they want to be career-wise until later in life, maybe during college. And I knew when I was 11. The reason I knew when I was 11 is I was in Boy Scouts, and I met a ranger, and his name was Earl Hensel. And Earl will remain forever in my mind, one of my true heroes. He worked for the Boy Scouts of America, and he wore a scout uniform as an adult, and on his left sleeve was a patch, and that patch said Ranger. And I didn't know at the tender age of 11 the difference between a Boy Scout camp ranger or a National Park Service ranger. What I did know at the age of 11 was that Earl Hensel was cool. This dude, he could do anything. He could light a fire, fight a fire, sharpen a knife, sharpen an axe, cook in a Dutch oven, cook over an open fire, paddle a canoe, saddle a horse, shoot a gun, shoot a bow, tie any knot. He was larger than life. And I just wanted to be like Earl. And if that meant being a ranger, then so be it. So that kind of kicked off this lifelong pursuit of mine to interview every ranger I ever encountered, which was fairly often, because as a scout troop, we went to state parks, national parks, metro parks, which are populated by rangers. So imagine 11-year-old little Kevin running around seeing this ranger on horseback and just, hey, how do I get your job? How do I become a ranger? You know? So I took notes. I stayed on track with that. And then I joined the service, the Army, and I became an Army Ranger. And then I got a bunch of college money after that. And I found a college that had a park ranger training program. And after that, got my first job at the Park Service. So I owe it all to Earl Hensel.
Wow. Do you have any highlights of your job or things that you really enjoy about being a ranger?
I sure do. If I had to wrap up the job of rangering in one word, that word would be adventure. Truly adventure, whether we are on a boat, running a raging river, class four, class five whitewater, skiing a slope of fresh powder. I got to go to the 2002 Winter Olympic Games and serve as a security force on skis during the Salt Lake City Olympic Games. So that was terrific. Climbing a high peak, patrolling of the world famous Appalachian Trail through Shenandoah National Park. There's true adventure in all of that. And I owe so much of those adventures to just doing this job. It's work, it's hard work, but there's a lot of fun to be had along the way. And if I could wrap up rangering in sort of one sentence, it would be doing noble work amidst magnificent landscapes alongside people of the highest caliber. So that wraps it up. And when I say noble work, it's protecting these beautiful places and also protecting the people and the resources inside those places.
Let's start talking about the waterfalls. Can you tell us a little bit about how the park's waterfalls were created?
Think of Shenandoah National Park as a ridge. And if you look at a map of Shenandoah National Park, it's long and linear. When water hits this ridge, it starts to run downhill, whether that be in the form of rain. Sometimes the water comes out from underneath the ground. We have a fair number of naturally occurring springs in the park. Either way, when the water starts coursing its way downhill, it's real narrow and real kind of skinny and small and not very, not a whole lot of velocity in the what we call the headwaters areas of a creek. But as it continues its way down the slope, it gets wider, it gets more volume, more velocity, and in some cases wider or steeper. It just continues on down with gravity sort of as the driving force. And so begins the process of erosion. And eventually these little river canyons are formed. And oftentimes, you know, the soil surface is eroded away and the water is in direct contact with rock. That rock can be hard in some places and softer in other places. And when it hits a thing called a nick point, that's a geologic sort of term used to define a steep region along a river profile. When water hits those nick points, it just drops. And it could be either a vertical falls or it could be more of a cascade, sort of a series of falls over a number of tiers. Dark Hollow Falls would be more of a cascade where it's multiple tiers that the water is actually dropping. So that's kind of the main way they're formed. One thing to be mindful of is, as I mentioned, harder rock and softer rock. Most of Shenandoah's National Park's waterfalls are on greenstone, which is a little bit softer rock than, say, granite or quartzite. So it does carve through greenstone a little more quickly than the other types of rock. We do have, I think, one waterfall near Old Rag pours over granite. And then another one in the south district of the park, Riprap Falls, and that's over quartzite. But just about every other falls in the park is through greenstone.
Is there anything else about the park's landscape that's unique?
Absolutely. The Appalachian Mountains are said to be the oldest mountain chain in the world. I think that's kind of cool. There's something mystical about that. It's a hardwood deciduous forest. Plenty of rain and precipitation. Some folks will even refer to it as a temperate rainforest just because there's so much rain and precip. In this region, in an average year anyway. And the other things that make Shenandoah's landscape unique are black bear population. It's one of the most dense black bear populations in the state of Virginia. And a lot of our visitors just really hoping to see black bears while they visit from a distance, so saith the park ranger. Exposed rocky summits are another really cool feature of this park, whether it's Old Rag or Bear Fence or Mary's Rock. Several of our hikes will wander and meander through that hardwood forest I mentioned, but then they'll suddenly top out with this 360-degree view. And even though you're not technically above treeline, you almost feel like you are. And that's a real cool feature of this park. It's also, you could think of Shenandoah National Park as a large protected landscape in the eastern United States. And it's also got several areas of designated wilderness. And when I say designated wilderness, that's with a capital W. The United States Congress actually approved legislation, not just making Shenandoah a national park, but then going one step further and making parts of Shenandoah a designated wilderness. The way I like to think of that is Shenandoah National Park is special. It's so special, in fact, that it's kind of special times two. It was special enough to be set aside as a national park. But then someone said, you know, parts of this park are untrammeled by man and far away from roads. we should further protect those areas. And so we did by designating them wilderness with a capital W. And then the last thing I'll say about Shenandoah that makes it unique is the waterfalls, which is kind of what this entire podcast episode is about. If you compare this particular section of the Appalachian Mountains with some of the ones nearby, like, for example, Massanutten, Ridgeline to the west, Shenandoah just has a lot of waterfalls, and it kind of makes it unique.
How many waterfalls are located in the park?
We're told that there's 36 named waterfalls. You can find waterfalls all throughout the park from milepost zero on Skyline Drive down to milepost 105 at Rockfish.
Not all waterfalls and waterfall hikes are the same. What do visitors need to know when choosing a waterfall hike that's best for them?
The two biggest things that they need to think about, the two biggest criteria are the distance that they want to hike, or the distance that they feel like they're prepared to and are able to hike, and then the difficulty. A hike could be 5 miles long, but not as difficult as a 2 mile hike, just because of the rugged terrain involved in the 2 mile hike. That would be the biggest two, distance, overall distance, and that means round trip. Whether round trip means out and back or a loop, we call kind of a circuit hike, and then also the difficulty. And just about every one of our waterfall trailheads will have an informational kiosk at the trailhead that advises both of those pieces of information. It'll tell the hiker how long the hike is that they're looking to embark upon, and then also what the difficulty that ratings that we use. We use easy, moderate, and then difficult and or strenuous.
What else do visitors need to do to safely prepare for a hike?
Well, first of all, they can go to our park website, and I believe you said that you'll make that available to folks. Is that right?
Yes, I will put any website that you mention, I'll put the link in the show notes.
Okay, so our homepage, it's a www.nps.gov, and that's nationalparkservice.government, and then SHEN, /SHEN. That stands for Shenandoah. When you get on that website, there's a tab for plan your visit. I would highly recommend doing some research prior to coming to the park. As far as your question, what else do visitors need to do to safely prepare for a hike? This starts before they ever get to the park. This starts at home. We are living in the day and age of information at our fingertips, and we go to great lengths. We have a terrific social media team here at the park, and they go to great lengths to make information available to our visitors before they even leave their house. So I highly recommend going to that website, clicking on Plan Your Visit, and just reading everything on there. You can also find maps of the park, and you can print them. And I'm a park ranger, so I believe in protecting our resources and reduce, reuse, recycle, all that. But in the case of a map, I strongly encourage folks to carry a paper map in their pocket, not just a digital map. And I'll kind of say more about cell phones and over-reliance on cell phones later on. But for right now, when you go to that website, please print maps of the whole park, really, but especially the area that you're going to. And then if you need more detailed maps, you can swing by our visitor centers and or our little gift shops that are typically near the visitor centers and purchase more detailed topographic maps. And then for free, you can get day hike maps right from across the visitor center counters. They're not topographic maps, but they're typically pretty detailed as far as like a hike to a particular waterfall. All right, so that's the first thing to pack is the map. And it doesn't hurt to carry a compass with that map, and then not just to carry the compass and the map, but to sort of know how to use those two objects together. It doesn't hurt to take a class in land navigation or orienteering. And then we also recommend what we call the 10 essentials. And two of those 10 essentials I just mentioned, that's the map and the compass, but also drinking water. Plenty of drinking water. Now, water's heavy, you know, it's close to 8 pounds a gallon, but especially on a hot day, your body sweats and you need to replenish the fluids that you lose due to that exertion. So carry plenty of water, and hey, think of it this way, the more you drink, the less you're carrying. With that water, carry food, high energy types of food. Also eat a good meal before you head out. That way your engine is fueled up, but also carry non-perishable types of foods in your pack. Especially high energy. Carry a first aid kit. in case something goes sideways, in case you're stung by an insect, in case you roll an ankle, in case you fall and have an abrasion, and can render some of that basic first aid to yourself or for somebody in your party, or even a total stranger if you encounter somebody who's injured along the trail. I already said map and compass. With the map and compass, most folks have some sort of GPS app on their phone nowadays. As long as your phone has good battery and good service, you might be able to use the GPS feature. Certainly nothing wrong with that as long as you have the map and the compass as a backup. A whistle. The reason you carry a whistle is if a person were to get lost, you could start blowing that whistle and it's going to travel a lot farther than just your voice. And the whistle is going to last a lot longer than if you shout it all day long, you're going to lose your voice. So carry that whistle just in case you need to attract somebody's attention. Light sources. And notice I said light sources with an S on the end, plural. Headlamps or flashlights are prone to dying if the batteries die or if you were to break a bulb or the bulb went out. So always have a backup. For me, I carry a minimum of three. Headlamps don't weigh anything. Nowadays, they're pretty affordable. Carry three or four of them. Even if you're going on a day hike, because a day hike can very quickly turn into an after-hours hike if something goes sideways. Appropriate clothing is one of the 10 essentials, and that's going to be hinge on what the conditions are. Remember, in the spring and in the fall, what we call the shoulder seasons, you can suffer hypothermia. That's when your body's losing heat more quickly than it can generate it, and it can get real cold as soon as the sun goes down, and if you were to get wet, that's a game changer. People do perish from exposure. You'll hear it, you know, oh, I died of exposure. Well, that means hypothermia typically, or if it's a desert park, it means heat stroke. But in our park, hypothermia can be a real thing. So when we say appropriate clothing, we mean insulation layers, waterproof layers, and then also protection from the sun, sunscreen, and a good hat. Another thing, it's not really an item that you'll carry in your pack, but check the weather. It never ceases to amaze me, folks who they say, well, I didn't expect it to rain. And it's like, I got four apps on my phone that tell me the weather, and all four of them are saying 90% chance of rain. So please check the weather and sort of have that weather forecast in the back of your mind before you head out into the backcountry. And then the last two items, so to speak, again, it's less of an item and more of a thing to do ahead of leaving, and that's communications. Tell somebody back home where you're going, about what time to expect you back, and then what to do if you're overdue. And overdue doesn't mean 10 minutes overdue. It means, like, you know, roughly speaking, maybe it's an hour past the time they said they were going to be back and I haven't heard from them. Advise them what to do. And then your emergency plan. And the emergency plan is less about telling people back home what to do if you're overdue and more about what are you going to do if you find yourself kind of in a tight spot while trying to enjoy the backcountry in a wilderness setting. Play the what if game and be prepared. So a big part of that is having the items in your pack that I just described so that you can enjoy an evening out, an unscheduled bivouac in the backcountry, even if you planned on just doing a day hike.
Let's get into some of the specific waterfall hikes. I know that some of these are really popular, and let's give people the information they need to know before they head out on the trail. So you and I picked a handful of waterfalls that we want to talk about today. So why don't we jump right in? Where do you want to start?
Let's go with White Oak Canyon.
All right, let's talk. That's a really popular one, and it's beautiful. Tell us what we need to know, Kevin.
Well, I'd be lying if I didn't show a little favoritism here. It might be my personal favorite waterfall hike in the park, and I think it's because of the sheer number of waterfalls. It's also one of the longer hikes. If you were to do there and back, like park up on Skyline Drive and hike downhill from the upper White Oak Falls parking and go to the upper waterfall and then hike back, that in itself is a little over 4.5 miles. But the better way to do the hike is to park at the bottom. We call that the eastern boundary, and begin your hike uphill and do the whole circuit. And the reason I say it's a better way of doing it is you get to see more. You actually sort of get two waterfall canyons for one trip, and that second one would be Cedar Run. The best part about White Oak Canyon is it's actually about a half a dozen. It depends on how you define a waterfall, but there's about a half a dozen waterfalls along White Oak Canyon just in and of itself. But in order to see that, you're hiking uphill for just about four and a half miles. And then you take the White Oak Fire Road as a connector over to Cedar Run, and now you're hiking downhill. I really recommend getting that uphill portion of it done first while you're full of energy, while you're not tired yet. And then when you're pretty exhausted because you've reached the upper falls, it's just downhill from there. There you're looking at not quite 9 miles to do that entire circuit. Two things. One, the upper White Oak Canyon Falls, it's the second highest falls in the park. So it's pretty glorious, 86 feet high. So that's one of the big drawing features of that particular hike. But here's something to think about. I really recommend doing this particular hike in those shoulder seasons, either after the leaves have all fallen in the fall or before leaf out occurs in the spring. And the reason for that is if all the leaves are on the trees, you don't get a really good view of some of those intermediate falls. You'll get a good view of the very lower falls and a good view of the upper falls, but the ones in between are kind of occluded by the leaf out, by the foliage. So if you hike it either during the spring or the fall when the leaves are not an issue, you'll be rewarded with multiple falls along the way. One thing to think about, if you were to hike it when freezing temperatures are possible, please bring what we call micro spikes. That's one piece of equipment I did not mention during the 10 essentials, but they absolutely are essential during the wintertime. You can Google it. You can look it up online. It's like a mini crampon. It's not a true ice climbing crampon, but it's just, think of it like a rubber boot shaped piece of equipment with metal spikes on the bottom. They simply stretch over the soles of your boots, and they give you the ability to grip an ice-covered trail. Absolute essential piece of equipment for our search and rescue teams, and an essential piece of equipment for our visitors if they're going to hike White Oak Canyon or any of our waterfall canyons in the wintertime.
Yeah, I think the shoulder season advice is great, because you're also avoiding the heat of the summer, which I think is when a lot of people do this hike. And it's strenuous. 9 miles in that type of elevation, that's a lot. Even for somebody who is experienced like I am, it's a long day. It's exhausting. And you know how hot it can get in Virginia in the summer, and the humidity and all of that. I think you're right when you say go during the shoulder season. It's just a more enjoyable experience. You're not feeling like you're going to die of exhaustion while you're hiking that trail.
Correct. Absolutely. You bring up a really good point. You know, in the summer, it's the humidity combined with the heat. It can be pretty, pretty grueling.
Should we move on to Dark Hollow Falls?
You bet. Dark Hollow Falls is, it may be the most popular one in the park. And I think that's partly because it's within walking distance of the Bird Visitor Center, which is right in the middle of the park. It's at Milepost 51 on Skyline Drive. Bird Visitor Center is within walking distance of Big Meadows Campground. So families that are camping in Big Meadows Campground, they could theoretically leave their vehicle at their campsite, hike down to the visitor center, get some good information on the waterfall, because that's what we want folks to do their homework, and then leave the visitor center on foot and hike right to Dark Hollow Falls. You're going to add a little bit of mileage by doing it that way, so just keep that in mind. But if a person wanted to just park at the Dark Hollow Falls parking lot, round trip hike is only 1.4 miles. So it's the shortest waterfall hike in the park. And I think that's another reason why it's one of the more popular ones. But keep in mind that hike back to the car is going to be uphill. So that's going to be some exertion if folks and aren't used to that type of exertion. And they may sort of fool themselves, because on the waterfall, it's pretty much uphill the entire way, and you're thinking, wow, this is an easy hike. Well, it's going to be uphill on the way back. A real beautiful waterfall. I mentioned earlier that it's sort of a cascade type morphology of riverbed, where it's not just one direct vertical falls. It's more of a series of falls going over multiple tiers. And I think the total height, if you take all those tiers together, are 70 feet high.
Yeah, it is a very steep hike down. And one of my pet peeves is when I see people posting information, quote unquote, about this hike on social media, and they label it as easy. I've heard that this waterfall hike has been nicknamed Heart Attack Falls. Is that true, Kevin?
I've heard that nickname unofficially, and it's because of that uphill trek on the way back. People get coaxed into this easy hike because it is downhill to the falls, and then halfway back uphill, they're starting to experience chest pain. So, yeah. It's an unofficial
Unofficial nickname, but that just gives you an idea that this is not an easy hike. But then can we also mention that there is an easier way to get to the base of the falls if you take the fire road?
It is easier. So here's the thing. When you get to the main waterfall on Darkhollow Falls, and you'll know it, it's pretty obvious. The trail takes you right to the waterfall. You could, from that point, you know, most folks want to take some photos, that kind of thing. You could turn around and go back to your car, and that would be your 1.4-mile round trip. The other option folks can have is to continue downhill. The trail, the designated trail, continues downhill to what we call Rose River Fire Road. And it's an administrative road, not open to civilian vehicle travel. It's an administrative road for Park Service personnel to use to access backcountry areas for purposes of firefighting, search and rescue, or any other real administrative purpose. But you can hike. You can hike on our fire roads. So if you wanted to go that way, you could continue downhill just a short distance. I think it's less than a half mile to the fire road. You get a second waterfall doing it that way because there's a real pretty little narrow kind of ribbon of a waterfall right where the trail meets the fire road, and good spot to rest, maybe have a snack, drink some water. And then you could either turn around and take the trail right back to your car, or you could take the fire road up to Skyline Drive. And at that point, you'd have to hang a left and follow the road shoulder back to Darkhollow Falls. It's easier in terms of steepness, but keep in mind it also adds length to the hike. And so some folks would argue that it's actually harder in the long run because it's just a longer hike.
Yeah, I guess it depends. If you don't want that steep elevation, I prefer the fire road when I have friends in town and they want to see a waterfall, but they maybe don't want to do something really intense. Taking that fire road it's just a nice meander through the forest. It passes by a historic area. There's an old cemetery there. I think there's a lot to see on that hike, and it's beautiful and it's enjoyable. And they get to see a waterfall, even if they're not hiking the entire length of the waterfall all the way down. They still get to experience some of it. So I kind of enjoy that fire road.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, there is a third option in this particular case as well. And right there where I described continuing past the main Darkhollow Falls down to the fire road where that ribbon of falls is located. There's a big steel bridge for vehicle traffic. Right there at that point, right on the other side of that steel bridge, there is a trail connector, a trailhead, so to speak, for Rose River Loop. And that would add 2.6 miles, so a little over 2.5 miles to the overall hike. But it's sort of a bypass of the Rose River Fire Road. If a person were to take that Rose River Loop Trail instead of the fire road, they get yet another waterfall. They get to see Rose River Falls, and that's 67 feet high. And it's its own just beautiful little waterfall. And by taking that loop trail, you actually top out at the top of the fire road. So you would be right there at Skyline Drive when you pop out of Rose River Trail. And again, you'd have to follow Skyline Drive back to Darkhollow Falls. But just wanted folks to know there is a third option there that involves another waterfall.
Do you remember the first time you experienced the majesty of a Shenandoah waterfall, the vastness of a rocky outcrop, or the solitude of a woodland trail? Shenandoah is a special place, which is why I'm proud to partner with the Shenandoah National Park Trust to ensure a sustainable future for our national park through conservation, education, and engagement. Federal funding for our national parks often falls short. SNP Trust is an official nonprofit partner that provides strategic investments in programs and initiatives that help protect, enhance, and preserve the resources of Shenandoah National Park for all to enjoy, for this and future generations. With the help of park supporters like you, SNP Trust can assist the park in providing educational programming, professional internship opportunities, funding for historic and scientific research, and so much more. Join me today in securing the future of Shenandoah National Park. Find an event, volunteer, or make a tax-deductible donation by clicking on SNP Trust in the show notes of your listening app to visit snptrust.org. Let's move on to Overall Run. Where is this one located?
Overall Run, if you were coming in from Front Royal, it would be one of the first waterfalls you can encounter if you make your trek southward down Skyline Drive. It's right. The trailhead is right there at Matthews Arm Campground, and you find it at milepost 21 or 21.1, so a little bit past 21. Park at Matthews Arm Campground, there is a sort of a side parking lot that accesses the Traces Trail. And then from that Traces Trail, you'll come to a junction, read the cement post that's in the ground with a little metal band, and it's going to tell you which way Overall Run Falls is. There is also a fire road that would cut off some distance. You'd still have to park in the campground and walk the fire road because, again, those are not available for public use. But it would make the overall run hike shorter. But it's a little bit of a hike. It's 6 miles, so round trip. So it's a little bit of an endeavor, but I would argue that it's really worth it because it's the highest waterfall in the park at 93 feet. Here's something to think about. It's if it hasn't rained a whole lot prior to the time a person goes to hike Overall Run, it's going to be a trickle of water, just real narrow. I recommend, and I actually recommend this for most of our waterfalls, after a heavy rain event or after maybe a few days of rain in a row, that's the best time to see the waterfalls in their full glory because they're just ripping. You know, especially again in that shoulder season where in the middle of the summer the trees are just sucking up the water from the groundwater because they gotta maintain all those leaves. In the shoulder seasons like fall and spring. Spring maybe so much because the trees are starting to bloom out, but in the fall there's going to be more overland flow, what we call, and that's going to just go downhill into the low spots, and it's going to go ripping through waterfalls. Real pretty time to see the waterfalls, especially Overall Run, just because it's going to make it sort of just a wider flow volume. One thing to think about if you're going to encounter our backcountry after heavy rain events is some of our trails require creek crossings, and those creek crossings are going to be deeper, colder, and swifter. So we just ask people to use their own good judgment. If they don't think they can cross a creek safely, please don't do it. Turn around, come back another day. So I want to be clear on that. I think it's a great time to see the waterfalls after a heavy rain event, but it could also mean the creek crossings might be a little bit trickier.
Yeah. Is it okay if I mentioned that in the off season, Matthews Arm Campground is closed? So then you have to park on the other side of Skyline Drive, and it makes the hike a little bit longer. But that's my favorite time to do it because when the campground is open, this is a really popular hike for people who are staying in the campground. But when it's closed, there's nobody there. You can get this whole thing to yourself.
Absolutely, for sure. The having an area to yourself, it harkens back to some of the language in that when I mentioned that part of Shenandoah is wilderness. The 1964 Wilderness Act has language in it that says we're outstanding opportunities for solitude. And you're absolutely right. When Matthews Arm Campground is closed, it's a great time to hike Overall Run Falls because you may literally have it to yourself. It does add some distance. You have to park immediately across Skyline Drive. There's plenty of parking for the public. You'll have to hike just straight down Matthews Arm Campground Access Road, which is paved. And it's a good little access road. It's, I don't think it's quite a mile, but it's got some length to it. Keep in mind, on the way out, that is also uphill. So it does add not only length, but some uphill travel to that hike.
Yeah, but I think it's worth it because when we're talking about some of the larger or taller waterfalls or more popular waterfalls in the park, it's very hard to find solitude. So this is one of those options where you can find solitude in the off season. So it's one of my favorites. Are we ready to move on to Doyle's River Falls?
Ma'am, you bet.
All right. Let's tell us what we need to know.
All right, Doyle's River is neat because if you're willing to just go a little bit further down the trail, another 0.6 miles, so you know, round trip of another mile, you get a second waterfall. So we kind of think of them as, you know, the uphill one and the downhill one, or Doyle's River Falls number one and Doyle's River Falls number two. And the second one is just more impressive. It's 63 feet high, whereas the first one you encounter is 28 feet high. So I highly recommend if you're going to go through the effort to hike to the first one, just continue downhill a little ways and go to the second one. They both are accessed from the same trailhead, and that is at milepost 81, real close to Loft Mountain Campground. So this is part of why we put our campgrounds where we put our campgrounds when Shenandoah was established back in 1935, I believe. Was because of the proximity to some of the more popular natural features in the park, waterfalls. So another relatively crowded one in the busy season. That doesn't mean don't hike it. It just simply means expect to not have it to yourself if Loft Mountain Campground is full or even close to full. So again, that's another one of those, why not hike Doyle's River in the shoulder season when the campground's closed? You'll just have a more likelihood of having it to yourself. You can also tie Doyle's River into the Jones Run Trail, and you get yet another waterfall, but you also add a little over 3 miles to your hike. And Jones Run is another 42-foot falls. So if you want to do an encounter a full day type hike, you could get 3 waterfalls in one trail.
I did this hike once in the summer. It was July, and there was pretty much no water at all. Like, you wouldn't even know that there was supposed to be a waterfall there. That's how dry it was. And the difference between when it has recently rained and then when there hasn't been any rain is just like night and day. So if you're there, I think in those dry seasons, it's worth checking in at the visitor center probably, right? Just to find out what the condition of the waterfalls are.
That's a great idea. The visitor center staff, the rangers there, will typically have a good read on whether they're flowing at all, or flowing high, or flowing low. The rangers in the visitor centers make it a point to patrol the waterfall hikes as often as they're able to. Plus, they also get information from hikers who, you know, hiked it yesterday, kind of thing. So if you're looking to get to see an impressive veil of the falls or the face of the falls, definitely swing by a visitor center and ask what the conditions are, and try to time it after we've experienced some rain.
Okay, last one, South River Falls.
South River is another one of my favorites, and the reason is that the beginning of this falls, the top of it, I'd say roughly the top third, is just a single veil, but then it hits a rock ledge with a kind of a big boulder protruding right in the middle of that ledge, and the falls themselves split. Think of it like a fork, almost like a pitchfork. And so at the bottom part of the falls is actually 2 waterfall veils. And it's just absolutely beautiful. It's powerful. There's an energy about this particular waterfall. Again, I don't encourage folks to approach too closely to it, but if you do take the time to hike to the bottom, you just get this terrific view. So, yep, kind of one of my favorites, just because of the way it splits halfway down. Oh, and it's also a pretty high one. It's 83 feet high. So I think that might be third highest in the park.
Did you already say how long the hike is?
I did not, and that's a good question. It's a little over 2.5 miles, 2.6 round trip. And again, that doesn't sound like much, but the hike out of South River Falls is not as steep as Dark Hollow, but it does have some elevation gain. So don't let that short distance fool you. It's still a pretty good little exertion.
Okay, so if somebody does one of these waterfall hikes and they reach the waterfall, and of course they're hopefully just going to be in awe because it's a really amazing experience. Now, what do they need to know once they're there about how to stay safe? Do you have any waterfall safety tips?
We sure do. We kind of have these universal waterfall safety tips, and you'll, anywhere you go, whether it's a U.S. National Forest Service or the National Park Service or state parks, areas that have waterfalls will typically adhere to 7 common safety tips around waterfalls. Okay. First of all, observe all posted signs. If we have a sign up that says stay on the trail, do not climb on the rocks, do not approach the brink of the falls, stay this side of a barrier, because some of them may have a physical barrier that prevents people from leaving the trail. Whatever the sign says, please obey that. So observe all posted signs. Stay on marked trails. This is another common denominator in some of our accidents is people left the trail. They wanted to get too close to the brink of the falls to take that all important photograph, and then they lost their footing and they slipped. So please stay on marked trails. This one's obvious to me, but we get people that violate this safety rule all the time, and it's do not jump off of waterfalls or dive into pools. Quickest way to get hurt is, this is not a swimming pool in the city park. It's not got that pretty little blue slide that lands in 10 feet of water that's got no obstructions underneath it. The water sometimes is very clear and able to you can see a little bit of the bottom, but it's also not a painted blue pool like you'd see in the city park. This is a dark substrate of the creek, of the river, and it's usually going to be loamy and leaf material and shadowy, and you're not going to be able to see it. You won't be able to see the bottom, so you have no idea what lurks below, so to speak, and it's usually a pig pen of rocks or submerged logs, that kind of stuff. So it's never a good idea to jump off of waterfalls or dive into pools because you just don't know how deep the water is or whether or not there's obstructions. And in order to jump off of a waterfall, you have to violate the other rule, and that's don't approach the edge of a waterfall because typically the rocks are going to be wet. And I said earlier, water on rocks equals slippery. It's a perfect recipe for someone slipping and getting injured. Another rule is do not climb on rocks above waist height. What we mean by that are just big boulders. We understand that people are going to get up on top of little blocks of rock and you know, maybe pose for a photograph. We get that. What we don't want people doing is climbing on rocks that are above waist height, because if a person falls off of a rock that tall, they're falling a greater distance, and the likelihood of getting injured is a lot more than if a person just stumbled off of a rock that, you know, a foot high kind of thing. Do not swim or wade upstream because, again, the current is usually stronger than people think it is, and very oftentimes a person can get swept over the edge. And then also expect rocks around waterfalls to be slick. Like I said, if they're wet, they're going to be slick. Just accept that as a truth and just don't climb on them if they're wet. And then the last bullet point is watch children at all times. Waterfalls have this almost intoxicating quality where they just lure you in, and they're entrancing, they're enchanting. I love waterfalls. I love the energy about them. I love the sound of them. They draw people in, and that includes children. Everybody is drawn to a waterfall. The thing about adults is hopefully we're able to make critical decisions and think clearly and use logic and life experience. But children don't always have that life experience at a tender age, and they can put themselves in a dangerous position without even knowing it. So please keep an eye on kids at all times, anywhere near a waterfall.
So what happens if someone needs to be rescued? Like, let's say there's an accident or some other type of incident near a waterfall. What happens?
Okay. When somebody falls near a waterfall or from a waterfall, typically it's going to be in a backcountry setting. Like I said, the closest waterfall to our front country is Darkhollow Falls, and even that's 3/4 of a mile just to get to it. So we can't just drive an ambulance to the base of a waterfall. So what happens is we spool up what we call ICS, and that's the incident command system. We call any rescue an incident. And there's a lot of moving parts that go into getting this person extracted from their unfortunate position at the base of this falls, or sometimes they're stranded mid-ledge on a waterfall. Sometimes they're in the pool at the base of the waterfall. But either way, they're in a place, a tricky spot, and we can't pull an ambulance up to them, so we got to go get them by some other means. We have to know about the incident in order to respond to it. So that would be the first thing that happens is the call for help goes out. That could be the person who fell, who's injured. If they have cell service, they're able to use their phone and call 911. Might be somebody in the party with the person, so a companion. It might just be a bystander that saw the incident and calls for help. Sometimes if we don't have cell service, a person has to run. They have to run the length of the trail to get to a place where they do have cell service or a trailhead or a road and flag somebody down. We have had some incidents. We got notified of them through like a spot device, kind of one of those geolocators, similar to the black box that you see in an airplane, but it's a personal locator beacon, a PLB. And these are the things that people can carry with them while they're hiking. A lot of cell phones now have an app where you can have an emergency beacon activated, and we have had some of those used to notify us of an incident. So that's the first thing. Once we get the call, we're going to start sending resources down there. When I say resources, I mean people. And that's either going to be rangers that are specially trained to rescue folks from backcountry settings, including cliffs in swift water, but then also volunteers. And that's one thing I do want to take a moment to mention, is, and that's the the astonishing dedication of a group of volunteers that we collectively call Shensar, and that's Shenandoah Search and Rescue. On one of your earlier podcasts, you interviewed a gal that was part of Old Rag Mountain Stewards. That's a group of folks that volunteer in the park to protect Old Rag Mountain, but they also respond to our backcountry search and rescue incidents. We also have Shenandoah Mountain Rescue Group. That's one of the rescue teams in this area that operates under the Virginia Department of Emergency Management. And those folks are just about every one of them are volunteers. We have the Shenandoah Nordic and Backcountry Ski Patrol, and they come out and help us with rescues in the backcountry, whether there's snow on the ground or not. Their specialty is skiing, but they volunteer even in the summertime. And then we also just have private citizens. We have a few paramedics that staff our ambulance in the park. A couple of them belong to a group called Orion Mountain Rescue. But again, they're volunteers. We have volunteer EMTs that help staff the ambulance. And these folks are terrific. And the reason I'm taking it to mention them all is we couldn't do this job without them. We don't have enough rangers on any given day, you know, to affect an entire rescue without the help of volunteers. So huge help in that regard. Once we get the resources down down the trail, we've got to find the person, first of all. We can't help them if we can't find them. There's an acronym in search and rescue, LAST, L-A-S-T, and it stands for locate, access, stabilize, and transport. Well, the very first one is locate. We have to find them first. Usually, if somebody says a person fell off of a particular waterfall, we're going to find them pretty easily at the base of that falls. But sometimes it's tricky. So once we find them, then we have to get to them. We have to access them. That might involve us rappelling down ropes to the base of the falls. It might involve us just hiking the trail with all of our rescue equipment, including a litter, a big Stokes basket, a big fat tire on the bottom of it. It might involve a helicopter. We have used helicopters in the past to insert trained personnel with medical equipment and rescue equipment, and then also to extract the patient out. That's a high-risk operation, and we don't like to do it unless it's really the only option and the quickest, safest option. Once we access the patient, we have to stabilize them. That includes treating any injuries they may have, doing basic life support, doing advanced life support if the injuries are serious, and then packaging them up, getting them in the litter, and then securing them to where they can stay in the litter and stay uninjured. We don't want to cause any further injuries just by jostling them around for a long haul out of the trail. As a person is hiking any of our trails in Shenandoah National Park, I'd like them to think about, well, what if I had to be carried out of the same trail, immobilized on a backboard in a Stokes litter? How much work is that going to require on the part of my rescuers? And it's grueling work. Some of the hardest physical work I think I've ever done in my life, hauling a person out of the woods. We may have a wheel underneath that litter, but it's still pretty darn hard work. Mm-hmm. So, and then typically we'll carry them out of the woods. That's the T, that's the transport. We'll get to the trailhead and there'll be an ambulance waiting for them, or in some cases, a helicopter. I think a take-home message with this is that the rescue process is long and difficult. Our resources are limited. We cannot drive an ambulance up to your location. You will not be rescued in a matter of minutes. It'll be more like a matter of hours. So it's got to keep that in mind when you're making decisions around waterfalls. Self-preservation needs to kick in. Like, I don't want to be injured, but just think about that. Like, if I am injured, it's going to be a long haul to get me to definitive care.
Wow. Yeah. And Kevin, one of the many hats that you wear, you are the SAR coordinator, right? The search and rescue coordinator.
Correct. Yep. That's
so you are trained in this, and this is one of your areas of expertise.
Yes, ma'am.
Kevin, is there one thing that you wish every park visitor knew either before beginning a hike or about Shenandoah's waterfalls?
Well, there is one thing, and there's actually two additional things. So I'm gonna take a little liberty here and give you three things that I wish every park visitor knew about our waterfalls, if it's okay with you.
Sure, go for it.
All right. The first one is when they go to our waterfalls. Remember, I said the shortest hike is 3/4 of a mile to Dark Valley Falls, with it being a mile and a half round trip. That's the shortest one. So that every other waterfall is a longer trek just to access it and to get back out. So please understand that you're entering true backcountry, including designated wilderness in some places. This backcountry setting, these waterfalls, they're glorious, and your hike will be highly rewarding, but it's also going to be challenging. And so our visitors have a responsibility to make smart decisions while visiting Shenandoah National Park and understand that those decisions can have the potential to affect other people. I just described what a grueling operation a typical backcountry carryout rescue is. So please, visitors, make smart decisions before you enter the backcountry and then while you're in our backcountry, and know that those decisions have the potential to affect other people if something were to go sideways. Another thing is, please do not over-rely on your cell phone. I said earlier in the program when I was talking about the 10 essentials that it's okay to have a cell phone. We want people to bring their cell phone. I want to be clear. Please bring your cell phone with you on your hikes. When you do that, please make sure the battery is as charged as it can be. On the drive to the trailhead, be charging your phone so that you have as close to 100% battery as possible. And then I'd actually recommend turning the phone off while it's in your pack. You know, I know people want to use it as a camera. I get that. But if you turn the phone off, then if you actually do need it in a tight spot, when you go to turn that thing on, it's going to have maximum battery. But the reason we don't want folks to over-rely on it is it's not always going to have battery, and it's not always going to have service. I like to tell folks that your cell phone is : and then I use the word not 4 times. And that drives home the point that here's what your cell phone is not. It is not a light source. And people say, well, yeah, it is. You know, there's a flashlight right here. It should not be your light source in a backcountry setting. That should be a headlamp. A couple reasons for that. Number one, you need your phone to do what it's supposed to do, and that's be a communication device. That light on your phone is going to drain your battery really quick. And then number two, most cell phones are not hand-free devices. A headlamp is. You can put a headlamp on your head, your hat, your helmet, whatever, and you can use your hands to use trekking poles or to do a task. It's in versus having your cell phone in your hand. The other thing a cell phone is not is a map. Oh, well, sure it is. You know, I got my map app right here. Well, yeah, you got your map app right there if you have service. Or some people will take a photo of our maps at our trailhead. That's better than nothing. But again, when that battery dies, not where's your map? Your map is useless to you. So that's why I rigorously advise people to carry not just a paper map, but a waterproof map, you know, made from the paper that's tear-proof and waterproof. You can buy them online. You can buy them from our visitor centers somewhere in the vicinity of $10. And it's one of the best $10 you'll spend. Because if you have an actual map, a topographic map, I promise you every single trail junction a person comes to in our park is going to have a concrete post with a little metal band giving directions. And if you take the time to take out that map, and then, of course, if it's nighttime, use your headlamp and compare the directions on that metal band on the concrete post with the features on the map, you're going to know at any given junction whether you need to go straight, turn left, turn right, or turn around in order to find it. Your car at the trailhead. All right, so it's not a light source. It's not a map. It's not a survival kit. You're not going to shake that cell phone and it turns into a 0-degree sleeping bag. Your cell phone is not going to keep you warm at night if you end up doing an unscheduled bivouac in the woods. And then the fourth thing that it is not is it's not always going to have battery or service. All right, so that's the second thing I want our visitors to know is please do not over rely on your cell phones. And then the third thing, on a positive note, is I like to think of our waterfalls in the park. They're really special for this reason. I said earlier that some of the other mountainous regions surrounding Shenandoah don't have the sheer number of waterfalls that Shenandoah National Park does have. Back in 1935, when this park was established as a unit in the National Park Service, the waterfalls were something that we looked at. If you think about the parks out west, like Yosemite and Grand Canyon and Sequoia Kings Canyon, Zion, some of these bigger western parks, they're known for their waterfalls. Well, so is Shenandoah. And because we had some of the falls that I've mentioned, Overall Run, White Oak Canyon, Cedar Run, Dark Hollow Falls, South River, Doyles River, Jones Run, and so on, it made this landscape extra special. And so the waterfalls themselves can be almost like, not that you thank a geologic feature, but like I say thank you to the waterfalls, because if it weren't for their existence, Shenandoah National Park may have never been considered to be a national park. And so we can sort of return that thanks. We can return the favor by protecting them. And we protect those waterfalls by looking at them as a almost like sacred ground, you know, and don't litter, don't deface them in any way. And then also don't do irresponsible acts like climb around near the brink or on wet rocks underneath the falls. Respect them is what they are, a very special place.
Kevin, it sounds like you really love and appreciate the park's waterfalls. What is it about Shenandoah's waterfalls that you love so much?
I said, you know, earlier in the podcast, you asked me what I love about Shenandoah, and my answer was everything. And I'll sort of say that toward our waterfalls too. I love everything about them. I love their energy. I love the sound that the waterfalls make in this otherwise quiet woods. I love the mist that forms at the base of the falls. Sometimes if the sunlight is just right, and the mist is just right, and that mist is going to fluctuate depending on how powerful the falls is, you can actually see a rainbow in the air. The changing levels of the waterfalls, they're just plain pretty. They're photogenic, you know, like, I mean, who doesn't want to take a photograph of a waterfall? And then I think maybe one of my favorite things about the falls is, in my mind, I think of certain elements in nature as being animated despite not being alive. So it's not a living creature, and yet it's animated. You know, you think of a black bear or a pileated woodpecker. They're animated. They move, and they move because they're alive. Well, there's certain elements in nature that are not alive, and yet they move. You know, wind, fire, gravity, and the way it affects things falling. Those things are all, they move, but they're not alive. Well, so water does the same thing. Water moves despite not being alive. So I think of it as like this animated force in nature that almost has lifelike qualities, even though it's not alive. I just love that about a waterfall.
Wow. What a great note to end on. This has been wonderful, Kevin. So much really, really great information here for people who are planning their hikes or planning their visit to the park. We do have to land this plane, but there's some information I want to get from you about how listeners can connect with the park or a park ranger.
That's easy. You can go to our website, which I read that earlier. It's www.nps.gov/Shen, S-H-E-N. You could also just, there's probably going to be a phone number on that website that says, you know, for park information, call here. And there's a front desk at our park headquarters where visitors can call in and ask questions. And then there's also our visitor centers. We have Dickey Ridge Visitor Center and Bird Visitor Center in the park. And those are staffed by rangers that are just begging to answer questions.
All right, Kevin, two quick questions. I ask this of all of my guests. First one is, what is one piece of gear you can't live without?
Parachute cord.
What?
Parachute cord, no, P cord. It's funny. Nowadays, you can get that stuff at Walmart. You know, it used to be you couldn't get bona fide, honest to God, no kidding, genuine, authentic P cord, parachute cord at Walmart. But nowadays, it's there. You know, go to the camping aisle. There are 1,000 uses for parachute cord. You can use them to lash a shelter together. I don't know if you know this, but in the movie For Your Eyes Only, James Bond, no kidding, climbed a rope using parachute cord. He took his bootlaces out, which were made of parachute cord, and he fashioned prussic knots, prussic hitches on the rope, and he climbed up the rope. And as a little kid, I'm like, no, he can't do that. Oh, yeah, he can. All you need is a little bit of parachute cord. So I don't go anywhere without it.
Oh, God. I was just waiting for you to do a movie reference. How many did you do when we were together the other day? It was like one after the other after the other. And I felt like I was a real disappointment to you because I don't watch movies and I had no idea what you were talking about for any of them.
James Bond. You can't be James Bond.
Okay. And the next question is, what is your next big Virginia outdoor adventure?
Well, my wife and I are talking about visiting the Great Channels Nature Preserve near Saltville. Just looks like an enchanting place. A couple of my friends have gone there and sent me some pictures, and it just looks like this area just with all these rocky, cliffy, bouldery little, literally channels that you can kind of hike through. So I want to take my boys that are 5 and 6 years old to visit that. And then Big Schloss, which is a rock formation right on the Virginia, West Virginia state line. It's just a little bit west of Shenandoah National Park. And I've got some friends who have visited that, and it's been on my list for a long time. So great channels and big schloss.
Sounds like fun. I hope you have a great time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Jessica. I've enjoyed this very much so.
Yeah, I appreciate you giving us your time, Kevin. I know you're very busy. In fact, you're on duty right now. I'm surprised we didn't hear your radio going off in the background, but this has been wonderful. I look forward to some upcoming waterfall hikes, and hopefully I'll see you around the park.
Absolutely. We'll be here. Thank you so much, Jessica. And okay. And also, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for giving the park an opportunity to get our message out there, sort of a twofold message. One, the park is glorious. Please come enjoy it. Please come visit it. And two, sort of a PSAR, a preventative search and rescue message. Please come enjoy the park, but do so in a safe manner to where you don't become one of those people that needs rescue.
Absolutely. It's all about responsible recreating. Well, thank you so much again for being a guest, Kevin. Adventure on.
Thank you, Jessica.
Links and resources from this episode are in the notes section of your listening app and on the website at virginiaoutdooradventures.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider supporting me. The easiest and most impactful thing you can do is visit buymeacoffee.com/Jessica Bowser, where you can buy me a virtual coffee or sign up for a membership. Members receive access to the full list of show notes, Virginia Outdoor Adventures vinyl stickers, and a shout out on the show. You can also support me by subscribing to the show on your listening app. Help spread the word by sharing the show or your favorite episode with friends or on social media. Last but not least, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I love hearing from my listeners. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Virginia Outdoor Adventures or on the website virginiaoutdooradventures.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, adventure on.